Okay, so what we did last time, which will take us through pages 1 through 4, so you don't have to be terrified by the number of pages. So we started by talking about the origins of the idea that Pidyon Shvuyim is the greatest of all mitzvot, which is famous from the Rambam. The Rambam gets it from a Gemara in Bava Basra. The Gemara in Bava Basra deals with the question where some mother of some important Persian figure, I didn't take a historical position as to who's who, gave a gift of money to an Amora saying this is for a mitzvah rabbah, and then he inquired, like, what's a mitzvah rabbah? And the answer was Pidyon Shvuyim. And then afterwards they tried to fit, right, this sort of became like, it seems like a rabbinic leitmotif. That thing that the rabbis say, Pidyon Shvuyim is a great mitzvah. Where did they get it from? And so they root it in a medrash, in a pasuk in Yirmiyah, which says that, you know, when terrible things are going to happen, so those people who get killed, those people who starve, starve, and those people who go into captivity, go into captivity. And captivity is, right, and the Gemara says all these things are in order of seriousness, so captivity must be worse than all of them because it has all of them. Okay, that's how we get to it. So I pointed out, A, that Pidyon Shvuyim is a great mitzvah in the context of what to do with public sukkah. Doesn't tell you that Pidyon Shvuyim is greater than Avodah Zarah, or Gilei Raos, or Shfichus Damim, or many other mitzvahs that are not the results of public staka. So it's a little bit of a weak read that way. And secondly, I pointed out there's another pasuk in Yirmiyah which lists the same things basically, but in different order. So it's not so you can't take it as a literary device. So it can always go in reverse order. And thirdly, you know, we said Shevi is worse because it has all of them in it. Okay. But it has all of it in, but maybe it doesn't have all of them in there with quite the same intensities. For example, like, you know, Shevi doesn't have being killed the same rate as being killed does. Right? So, all in all, I was not convinced by the source material that Pidyon Shvuyim is actually the greatest of all mitzvot. One has to be cautious about such rhetoric in the same way one has to be cautious about all rhetoric about X mitzvah is equal to all the other mitzvot put together, because, you know, there are 11 of them or so that are equal to all the other put together. That creates a minor mathematical issue if you try and figure out what is supposed to happen. Okay. The Rambam, you know, goes to town about Pidyon Shvuyim, and I don't want to claim it's not a great mitzvah. I just think that, you know, that when you put things as the greatest, right, then you already are risking something. Okay.
That is the Rambam's wording.
No, he just said, well, is ain lecha mitzvah gadol ki Pidyon Shvuyim. There's no mitzvah quite so great as Pidyon Shvuyim. Okay.
He's just telling you it's a good one.
Yeah, it's a big one.
It's up there.
Exactly right.
Yeah, the Lashon Kuzma, though, like, it's not.
Yeah. Right, don't, you're not bound by it to take it with excessive seriousness. Okay, that takes us to pages 1 and 2. On page 3, I pointed out that there's a machloket, not so well known, a double machloket between an anonymous Tanakhama and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel as the first Breita, and in different versions, either anonymous Tanakhama or Rabbi Yonasi. Most Rishonim, I think, have Rabbi Yonasi and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel in the second one. People generally assume that this Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is Rebbe's father, not the first Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. And the two machlokot about Pidyon Shvuyim and husbands. The first machlokot is, does a husband have to redeem the wife if the captors ask for 10 times her value? Whatever value is defined as, k'day de mehen. And the second is, does the husband have to redeem his wife if the captors ask for 10 times her ketubah? Okay, so her ketubah is her value, right? You might say it's her value to the husband, right? Whatever you want to frame. Okay, so there's two machlokot, right? In each case, the first position says that he has to redeem her the first time, and he has, or that, well, I shouldn't read it. Pam rishona pode, mikan ve'lech ratza pode, ratza eno pode. Right? That's the first position each time, right? That something is different between the first time and the second and third times. Right? Whereas Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says about the 10 times her worth, and put it as hashvuyim yoster al kadei demayim nipnei tikkun ha'olam. Right, we don't redeem captives for more than they're worth because of tikkun ha'olam. But is he talking about? Is he objecting to redeeming her the first time, or objecting to redeeming her the second and the third time? We don't know.
Well, he seems to make a blanket statement.
Could be, right? We'll have to figure out.
Don't pay more.
Could be. But then why is he talking? You know, so then the question is, what's the context of husbands? We'll talk about that in a moment. Like, why is the context husbands if that's the case? Maybe he's saying even husbands. It could be. Okay, that's the first machloket, and the same second machloket is exactly the first position is the same. The first time yes, and the second and third times he wants yes or not. And Rosh Hashanah this time says He is poda if it's equal to Rektuba and not if not. And Rashi gives svaras, a peculiar svara for Rabbi Gamliel the second time, which is that we shouldn't allow her value, we shouldn't allow the obligation of the husband to redeem her, which is a secondary obligation, to exceed the value of Rektuba. So that's great if he's talking about the second and third times, and he just says, well, the first time he should redeem her for the value, and the second and third time he doesn't have to do it at all. But if he has to redeem her more than one time on any value, it's going to be more than the ktuba. It's just going to be the ktuba at a shot. It's not clear exactly how these positions play out.
Why is the ktuba used as a marker of value for her?
So it's not used as a marker of value for her. It's used as a limit of obligation for him.
But doesn't he have to get tzedakah just like everybody else has to get
sure,
tzedakah?
And he has to give the same amount, right? Once he pays the ktuba, so then the community has to redeem her, and he has to pay his fair share. Mm-hmm.
Because that's the amount that he would owe her in the dissolution of their marriage.
Well, yes, but that assumes something, right? That's an assumption. If that's the case, so why does Rebbe disagree? Now, Rebbe seems to think the ktuba is irrelevant the first time, but then the question is, what's the difference between the first time, the second, and the third time? All right, so we have to invent a whole lot of legislation. Now, Rashi on the first Braita says the lo tekida bar rabbanon elachad pidyon, that the whole obligation of husbands to redeem wives is a rabbinic decree, and they only said you have to do it once. Right, that's Rashi's claim. Husbands only have to redeem their wives once.
When you make a halakha about something,
yeah,
the presumption that on his own he wouldn't.
So the question we're going to have to address all the way through in these machlokot is, right, each machlokot can be, if there are three ways of constructing them. One is the machlokot is one person says obligated, the other person says not allowed. And then you have two positions in which one person says allowed, right, and the other person either says obligated or forbidden. And you can shift, obviously, Rebbe's position, and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's position, right? So either of them could hold permitted, right? Rebbe can hold either permitted or obligated, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel can hold either permitted or forbidden. And that's true of both of these machlokot. Okay, right? So that's our initial option. Right? You start playing out the right, so you can get statistics in anyway, right? Start playing out the combinations of permutations, and you can figure out how many different constructions of the positions you can have so far. Okay, then we have to decide, right, to what extent is the machloket about ketubah presumably is limited to husbands and wives. The machloket about worth is not necessarily limited to husbands and wives. But there are two ways in which you can make husbands unique in terms of worth. You can say husbands are unique because they have a greater obligation. Husbands are supposed to, right, there's some kind of decree that husbands are supposed to redeem their wives regardless of costs. Or you can say husbands are unique because they have a greater right. Because husbands' relationship to wives is such that redeeming your wife is just like redeeming yourself, and it's implausible that we put limits on how much money you can spend to redeem yourself. Ishto kegufo. Okay, so we can say, right, we can say even husbands are permitted, or even husbands, right, or even husbands, right, or even husbands are forbidden, right? Right, all depends which way we, which, yeah.
Tikkun olam is a consideration part of this. Why would you say there's no limit to how much I can spend to redeem myself? Let's say, you know, somebody can ask me and they say, call your banker, right, and have him, you know, remove.
Maybe we'll tell the banker not to answer.
Your account, and I do it.
Excellent.
And doesn't that still encourage the same thing to happen?
So it could be. So we could answer yes. There's tikkun olam. There's a reasonable limit on what you place for tikkun olam. In any case, that only the risk is only that they'll seize rich Jews. There's the risk that they'll seize ordinary Jews. Or we could say you're right. The people who think that there's an additional right to redeem your wife must also believe that there's an unlimited right to redeem yourself. But the people who don't allow you to redeem your wife might not agree with that. Right, I'm not aware of anybody who explicitly says you're not allowed to redeem yourself. Right, but you could construct such a position, in theory. Okay, now as to how we paskin, there are two pieces of external evidence right now. One piece of external evidence is that there's the Mishnah immediately preceding the Gemara's citation of these machlokot says that in that redemption is a tnai ketuba. Right, that even if your ketuba doesn't say "and I will redeem you from captivity," it's still enforceable. A wife can still present the ketuba to a Beit Din and say right and say you owe me. And the Beit Din right, my wife's in captivity. I don't want to redeem her. Tough. Right? It says so in your ketubah. So you might say that the ketubah, since it says it in the ketubah, and the ketubah doesn't put any limits about anything, doesn't say how much, doesn't say how many times, so you can treat the Mishnah as supporting the initial position in both brachot. Right? You can treat right. The response to that is not complicated. The response to say is no. The statement in the ketubah is in accord. I have to redeem it in accordance with whatever the standard obligations of husbands are. And the standards obligations of husbands are bounded by law, right? I don't have to steal the money to redeem you. So the same token, I don't have to pay more than the cost because that's against public interest, right? So, but some Rishonim think that this is a compelling case, that there's a Stam Mishnah, and the Stam Mishnah supports the initial position in at least one of those machlokot. Right? The other is that the position of Rav Shimon Gamliel in the first machlokot, Ein Podin Es Shvuyim, is also a Stam Mishnah with no context at all in Gittin. Gittin just quotes that statement, no machloket.
The same exact statement.
Ein Podin Es Shvuyim Al Kedei D'Mayim Etikun Olam, with no context of husband and wife. So you could say, oh, look, that Mishnah clearly supports the position of Rav Shimon Gamliel. Or you can say, no, that just tells you that that's the halacha when it's not dealing with husbands and wives. When it comes, right, that's why that's a Stam Mishnah without mentioning Rav Shimon Gamliel's name. And here, Rav Shimon Gamliel's claim that it's extended even to husbands, right, even to husbands and wives. Right, so we have a reason to paskin like Rav Shimon Gamliel. We have a reason to paskin like Rebbe. And we have ways to get to the same results regarding husbands and wives regardless. Okay, then if we choose to make an extension for husbands one way or the other, then we have to figure out, so what, right, for husbands and wives one way or the other, we have to figure out what is the nature of that extension. So if it's because ishto kegufo, so you have to figure out, you know, is that a legal status or an emotional status?
There's implication for other family members.
Absolutely.
Children.
Absolutely. Children is the simplest. Children is the simple and obvious right question, right? Do you have a right to redeem your children? Or parents? Yeah. So maybe, but if, so if it's an obligation, maybe not. But if it's a part of it's a right, maybe it's something else. Right? So that's one formulation, right? Ishtoki, right? If we say the ground is ishtoki gufo, so we can say that's emotional, in which case we extend it, or we can say it's a legal status, then we have to look for other places where we say somebody else is kegufcha. And it's going to be hard to find cases other than wives where we really say that in a very literal sense, but maybe we can come up with some. Okay, alternatively, we can say that wives are different because wives have a lien. That's what a ketubah is. Wives are different because when we set up the marriage relationship, we set it up with an obligation of redemption, and that obligation, for whatever reason, the rabbis chose to make absolute. Then it has nothing to do with anybody but wives. But then it has to be an obligation, not a permission. Okay, all right, so that basically gets us through page 4, I believe. Except I want to, right, so, right, we showed you how there's a machlokas rishonim, and the position, the Rambam and the Rif sound one way, but you can, right, but again, every time somebody passes a machlokas, you still don't know which way they are, which way, you have to figure out what they mean by the machlokas, right, and since most of rishonim basically just say we passing this way, right, that doesn't tell us what we actually, just tells us who we paskin like, not how we paskin, because we can massage, right? Pretty much everyone has agreed that we don't paskin like Rav Shimon Gamliel about the ketubah. Okay, that doesn't help us so much. Okay, so I want to take a look at the Shulchan Aruch, because you'll see how all these machlokot rishonim will play, all the ambiguities play out in the Shulchan Aruch as well. Right, it's an interesting question with the Shulchan, you know, what the job of the Shulchan Aruch is. Is the job of the Shulchan Aruch to disambiguate? Or is the God of Shulchan Aruch to tell you how we paskin a machloket and leave the machloket ambiguous? All right, same issue with translations, right? Sometimes as a translator, you think your job is to disambiguate. And sometimes you think as a translator, job is to preserve the ambiguity. And when you're writing halachic digests, right, the, you know, the both those options are open. You have to decide. So here's the Shulchan Aruch. Ein mechayvim et habal liftot et ishto yoter al demeha, ela kemosh hishaveh kishar hashvuyot. Okay, we don't obligate the husband to redeem the wife more than whatever demeha, however we measure demeha, just whatever she is shaveh, just like any other captive. Okay, this is a quote of the Rambam, and it sounds very clearly like ein mechayvim et habal, but the Baal has permissions.
Yeah.
Right, so, whereas presumably if we paskin generally, right, like the state, like the Mishnah, which says ein podinus of shumiyot ralgidei demehem, right, other people don't have the right, but husbands have the right. That's the simplest way of reading the Shulchan Aruch on the basis of the Rambam. To which the Rambam adds, v'yesh orim the ishto ki gufo dami, v'yachol liftot b'chol asher lo. So Ramah says that there are some people who say that because your wife is like your goof, you're able to redeem her. So that sounds like him, right? That there's some people who say you're able to redeem her, as opposed to the position the Shulchan Aruch quoted, which says you're not able to redeem her. And right, and the Ramah doesn't say that b'yeshom and ishto k'gufo dami, therefore chayev liftot b'chol asher lo, just yachol liftot b'chol asher lo. So we could read the Shulchan Aruch and Ramah as having a fundamental but unacknowledged machloket. Right, Rav Yosef Karo paskins that husbands are not obligated, right, or actually, they say it's having an agreement that they refuse to acknowledge. Right? Rav Yosef Karo says we don't obligate the person, but of course he has a right. And the Ramah says he has a right. Right. So now you might argue that the Ramah thinks that it's forbidden for everyone else other than husbands, whereas the Shulchan Aruch thinks it's obligatory. Right, could be, but rough to know. Right, it's tempting to say that there's a machlokas mechaber to Ramah.
He recognized the ambiguity, and he wanted to at least make it clear that there are at least some positions. And when the Ramah says Yesh Omrim, does that imply that he is that his position?
Usually, the rules are that when the Ramah says Yesh Omrim, just right, without an alternative position, he just says Yesh Omrim. That's how he passes. Yeah, and to say okay, because he was clearing up the ambiguity, but he said Yesh Omrim because there's some right. That's clever. Could be true, but it's hard, you know, hard to know. Okay, whereas Hayud Damel Ali Al Gdek Ktubata Ve'Amar Hareni Megarsha V'Zuk Ktubata V'Telech Tifideh Et Atzma. Okay, here the Shulchan Aruch continues following the Rambam, right, which gives you much more information than the Rif does, even though he paskins the same way. I talked about it last time that the Rambam says there are only 10 points where the Rif is wrong. It doesn't mean he agrees with the Rif everywhere. Just means there are 10 points where he disambiguates as clearly disagreeing with the Rif. So he paskins the same way the Rif does in the Machlokot, but he has a new thing. He says that the husband can remain married to a wife and just refuse to redeem her. It's just that the obligation drops to the level of the ketubah once he's redeemed her once. Right? Because the ketubah has two separate features. One is he has an obligation to redeem her, and second, he owes her a ketubah. So the first time he redeems her, he uses up the obligation of the ketubah. Now she's captured again. So he can redeem her if he wants, or he can divorce her.
What's the obligation in the ketubah to redeem her?
It says in it's an ketubah that I will redeem you.
It's not in our standard.
Yeah, but the Mishnah says even if you don't write it, it's obligatory.
Was it in older versions, or was it just implied?
So there's a whole discussion about that, but in the Mishnah clearly it was there.
Uh-huh.
But it's a one-time only.
So that's what, right? So the Rambam learns it that it's a one-time only obligation, which, right, because we paskin like Rebbe against Shimon Gamliel, it's not limited to the amount of the ketubah.
Put in the ketubah.
Yeah, right. Let's make sure the Rambam paskins. You demand your tzar ketubah. Sorry, there was another way. The Rambam thinks that it never goes above the ketubah, but he thinks the first time he has an obligation to. Because the paskin is like Ravan. If she's worth more than her ketubah, right? So really, they're asking market price, right? Let's set it right. The captors ask market price, but the market price is higher than a ketubah. So then he can't say I'm only paying the ketubah. He has to pay the market price. He doesn't have to pay more than the market price, right? We said in mechayvim, but he has to pay the right. The first time, husband has to pay the market price, regardless of the ketubah. The second time, now that he's used up his obligation to pay market price, the second time he's allowed to divorce her and say, "Here's your ketubah." But it's not like that. It's not like that. He can just say, right, he can't hold her as an aguda. All right, say, oh, well, you know, she's captured. Good. All right, they can't do that. Right, he has to. I say that's, I think, the consistent with the Rama's general position that wives are not, right, the wives are not slaves. Right, so if you don't want to redeem your wife, okay, that means you don't want to be married. So obey her ketubah. Okay, right, I think that's right. You could have an interesting question, like what happens if she's lost her ketubah for whatever reason, things like that. But this seems like a okay. Yeah.
How do you practically, you know, actuate that? She's been captured. I guess the idea is that he can cash it in for her and pay the money. And on her way out, he'll give her the ketubah and say,
"By the way, she'll have to agree." Right, she'll have to agree. Right, that, you know, to deliver, he can eat. Right, the ketubah is a receipt. Right, it's a quitclaim. So she, right, so she has to deliver the ketubah to him, right, in exchange for the money. Mm-hmm. All right, that's probably the way you would handle it. Okay. Now the Rama adds on this, but without this, right, without divorcing her, without an agreement for divorce, he has no obligation to redeem her a second time without divorcing her, right? So if she refuses a divorce, he has no obligation to redeem her. Okay, right, consider yourself whether you think the Rama is just playing out a natural implication of the Beis Yosef, or whether he's adding something that the Beis Yosef would not have said on his own. I think that that's also open to the room, but I'm less interested in that question than I am in the greater than her worth value. The ketubah question is local to husbands. Okay, that takes us to where we were last week. Now we turn to page 5. The question, so the rabbinic conception, I think, generally of marriage is, aside from, like, there's a fundamental relationship of marriage, and the fundamental relationship of marriage is physical. And then there are all the economic relations, like the other aspects of marriage, which are negotiable. And the language of Rashi's Shul Tikkun Chachamim suggests that this is a rabbinic. There's nothing intrinsic in the marriage relationship that makes, right, that makes husbands have to redeem wives. It's just something the rabbi threw in. Okay, and in general, right, so there's a whole debate whether ketubah is deraisa or derabanan, right, and to what extent ketubah is deraisa or derabanan, but in general, the way I think is most reasonable to think of the ketubah is the rabbis try and give women the most they can in a way which does not discourage men from marrying. Right, so it's a game theory thing, right? How much can we obligate men towards, right, husband, men towards women if they marry them without discouraging men from marrying them? So they figure, like, redeeming captives, that's, you know, okay, it's a gamble, but it's like, you know, it's not a high odds. So you can throw in, like, all sorts of unlikely things, and it's not really gonna discourage people from marriage, right? So they threw this in. But almost all of these things are conceived of as quid pro quos. You get this in exchange for that. And they're not going to be their obligations of wives towards husband, their obligations of husbands towards wives, and those of them are framed as quid pro quos, right? There are no, outside of sexual, there are really probably no non-negotiable elements, and even sexuality to some extent is negotiable. But sexuality isn't framed as a quid pro quo. Right? That's an inherent obligation. Everything else is a quid pro quo. So here we go. Tana Rabbanan, here's a braita. Tiknu mazonotea tachat maaseyodea. So the rabbis drill that husbands have an obligation to support their wives in exchange for that right, that husbands have a right to the wives' work product. Okay, then we have a whole discussion where we paskin that wives can, right, say, okay, I'm going to support myself. No, I don't need, right, I don't need you to support me, and now you don't get my stuff. Right, that's wives' options in the context of marriage. Okay, that's straightforward. Then the text we have is ukvura ta, tacha ktubata, and the husband's obligation to bury his wife. Right, so a dead woman does just become a meitat mitzvah, right? Is in exchange for her ketubah, which Rashi explains means the property that she brings into the marriage, and he is allowed to use. Right, so wife brings property into a marriage, which she retains control of the principle of. And the question is, right, she bred who gets the usufruct while they're married? So Gemara says, lefichach bal ochel peros. Therefore, the husband, right, therefore the husband gets the usufruct. So Gemara says, peros? Who talked about peros? We talked about ksuba. Okay, so you can say that's implicit in the nature of ketubah, like that, that's the kind of the aspect of the ketubah that generates peros, but not every aspect of the ketubah generates peros. So the Gemara thinks this is a problem. So the Gemara says, "Chisurim mechastra v'achi ketani." So chisurim mechastra v'achi ketani is a challenging thing, right? On the simple reading of it is that there's an error occurred in the memorization process, and you have to insert more words into the Mishnah. And usually people, you know, so the interesting, you know, say, right, but how do you do that, right? You have a text. How can you totally change the meaning of the text by adding words into it? That's cheating. So Professor Yaakov Elman of Yerushalmi is to point out that Chisurim Mechashra never occurs in the Yerushalmi. So it's hard to view it as a Masoret in that way, but often it's actually just the equivalent of a Hachik Amar, which is it tells you this is how you ought to read it, right? It's not telling you, okay, so you can decide which one of it is in this case and how convincing it is. I also tell you that in manuscript, and I think this is actually compelling, in manuscript, you'll see the next line doesn't make sense without it. It's actually Upir Kuna Ukvuratat Tachik Tubata. It's her redemption and her burial in exchange for the ketubah. You'll see why it matters that line is, that other word is in the Mishnah, right? So you have the structure of the Mishnah is very neat the way we have it. It's one for one. Mazona in place of Maser Daim, Kvura in place of ketubah. And then we have this thing, peros, what's going in? So we're going to insert a third category, and that's going to match peros, and everything is great. But the third category is totally invented. Right? Who meant right? Redemption doesn't exist. So you can make the original Mishnah unbalanced, and you say, well, there's one for one, which is Zonos and Masya Daim, and two for one, which is Pirkun and Kvura for Ketubah. And now we say, oh, that looks unbalanced. So Chisuri Mechasra makes sense, because really right, we have three things the husband gets, Masya Daim, Ketubah, and peros. And we have three things that the husband gives. All right, so that's how the Gemara reads it. Peres, right? Chisur mechashra chitane, tiknu mezono tachat maase yodeha, upirkuna tachat perot. Okay, and he eats, right, and he redeems her in exchange for peros, but now we exchange the peros are no longer the peros of the ketubah. The peros now are the peros of assets that come to her after marriage. Right, if she inherits assets during the marriage, so he eats those fruit, and the kvura is in exchange for the thing she brings in for the ketubah. Okay, so now we have a new balanced Mishnah, and that's all right for our purposes. That's what matters. We now have a claim that when the rabbis institute an obligation to redeem, they institute it in exchange for his eating the fruits of whatever assets she gains during the marriage. Okay, fine. That's a Gemara says my lefichach, but what do you mean? Therefore, the husband eats fruits, right? Once you put in three things, there's no lefichach anymore. Right now, it's just this for this, this for this, this for this, right? Lefichach sounds like it's causal. So the Gemara says, right? It's very hard to read this line of the Gemara, and the text is also a mess, and I'm not going to be able to do it, right? So Gemara, the next four lines of Gemara, so we'll just phrase it this way. The next four lines of Gemara say is something like this. You might have thought that she would prefer not to have an obligation. She would prefer not to have an obligation not to redeem, not have an obligation to redeem, and get to keep the property. And the answer is no, because we want lefichach means because we want him to right. We want him to have to redeem her. We don't want him to decide to redeem her based on whether she's worth it to him or not. Therefore, we established this quid pro quo. Okay, also because we switched it to peros as opposed to maaser, right? It's not based on maaser yadayim or ketubas, right? So now, right, if she's right, she can't negotiate the other way really either. Interesting question whether what would happen according to this position if she explicitly wrote a shtar saying, I want to keep all the property I get after marriage in exchange for redemption, right? Does she have to make the deal before she gets any property, even after? Okay. But that's right. That's the way the Gemara ends. The Gemara says, hang on a sec. What gives you this, once you're changing the whole text of the Mishnah around, why do you want to do it that way? Maybe do it the other way. Let's say that she gets redeemed because of Masya Daim, and that she gets supported because of his ability for the use of her assets. So your answer is, Tiknu Matsui la Matsui, v'she'enu Matsui l'she'enu Matsui. That, right, when Chazal are trying to create a parallelism, right, and again, I think you have to be careful not to think of it as that they're thinking causally. They're not thinking causally. I don't think that's correct. They're thinking, right, what is the best way to set up the relationship? Which things are best connected to other things? So when they set it up, this right, and that part of that is psychological, right? They want everyone to feel they're getting a fair shake in the context of marriage. So they set it up, right? Say, like, things that are common. Yeah, so you get something that's common and things for things that are common. And things that are uncommon, you get for things that are uncommon.
So that mean if there's no payroll, then you don't have to redeem her?
No, because that's the point. It's a risk. When you marry, right, you would take a gamble, right? And the gamble is, right, you accept an absolute obligation to redeem her, and you might win or might lose. Depends on whether she gets money afterwards.
So it's not really a quid pro quo. It's for the possibility that she...
Yes, could. it's a quid pro quo, but it's a game theory quid pro quo. Right, right. He has an absolute obligation in exchange for a lottery ticket. Right, and they figure that, right, but it's a lottery. But the thing is, right, this is the simplest way of reading it. Redemption is also like the expense of redemption is also a lottery ticket.
Yeah.
Right, he's not really right. So that's the simplest way of reading it is to say that. Right, the way Rashi says it is. Right, so the constant aspects of marriage. Right, he's going to have to support her. And she's probably going to have some kind of work product. That usually happens. So therefore, right, so that makes sense. So in the ongoing nature of the relationship, nobody ever says to the other person, hey, look, this is unfair. I'm doing all this for you and you get nothing. No. There's an ongoing thing. And then there are two lottery tickets. She gets a get out of captivity free card. And if somebody gives her money, right, he gets her stuff. He gets to use the stuff. Right, that's the way Rashi explains it, a very reasonable way of thinking about it. Right. In general, I think it's really important to, right, that Chazal have a really good sense of probabilities that way. Right, that, you know, that you know, they understand, right, that, you know, figure out how you discount money with all the, you know, later things that people enjoy. Like somebody won a Nobel, right, late in the 20th century for discovering that people don't actually weight money rationally. People value money they already have. More than the chance of getting money, even though statistically it's exactly the same. So that's all, right? Because Chazal have a set of principles, which, you know, in this case, right, Chazal were way ahead of the game. Probably every rational person was ahead of the rational economic theory in that regard. Everyone understands that people don't think totally rationally about it. But okay, right? So Chazal have that, you know, there are a lot of things which it's, I'm very grateful always for being introduced to, Chavev has actually bought me a book on game theory and law, and it opened up a whole set of things that I didn't really understand previously. Okay, that's Rashi. Here's Tosfos. Tosfos says, "Ratzai no pudeh." Right now, we're back in the Tosfos Luxubot. Right on the first machloket about whether he has to pay, right, whether machloket in Rebbe, who says he has to redeem her the first time. And has or can redeem her the first time, and has the option of choosing of redeeming her the second and third times. Tosfos says, right, Rashi explains, "Delo tekina rabbanan lachad pidyon," because the ketubah only establishes one pidyon. Mashma mitoch pirusho. So Tosfos says it sounds from Rashi, "Dimnish beit pam shenit," that if she's captured a second time, "they know pudek klal afilu bidomea." He has no obligation to redeem her at all. Even at market price. Okay, Tosfos doesn't know about the Rambam's idea that he has to pay her the ketubah. Right, that's not his issue. It's just there's no obligation, right? Whatever you think happens after that, but there's no. Tosfos thinks that Rashi says that the clause in the ketubah is one, right? One get out of captivity card. That's it. The kasha, to le'el maskinan tiknu matzur lematzur. That doesn't make sense, is because earlier we learned that they establish as matzur lematzur. Demashma deperos upirkon mitzuyin yoter miksuba ukvura. Uh-oh. The Tosfos learns the reverse of Rashi. Right? He thinks that redemption is more common than ketubah and kvura, because it can happen more than once. You never have to pay a ketubah more than once. You only get married once, hopefully. But you can get captured multiple times. You can get lots of different amounts of, right? You can get lots of different requests. So Tosfos thinks that the matsui and the ena matsui are reversed from Rashi. If that being the case, that assumes that you have to get redeemed more than once, because that's right. It can't be matzah unless it can happen more than once.
During the Crusades, when Balakos were around, were there more hostages than during Rashi's time? I don't know.
Heart. I mean, yeah, heart.
It
I
might
don't.
not be historical. It's just the fact that certain things can happen more than once.
Other well, things that, that's the chat what he's saying, but I think. Could be saying it's just more.
Could be. I don't know. You know, I don't know which. You know, we know that Rabbi Rutenberg is captured. Right? Does Rashi, according to I read Agus, Jacob Agus's fascinating book on right where he, which I don't know like how well held this is. There's a lot. It puts a lot of weight on one text, which not obviously means what he says it means. But he argues that the Jews up until the First Crusade are just living the good life. And like, you know, there's nothing better. Like, if you want, like, you wanted to pick a period in history to go back to, you want to be the Jews, right? Just before the First Crusades. Maybe it wasn't common then. It's only he argues that the Jews have a system of protection that enables like everybody else is getting captured left and right, but the Jews have a system which enables them to. Right, they have an intelligence system, and they have a posse system that lets Jews travel the roads of Europe, and so Jews are like dominant figures until the First Crusade. Which utterly. So, in that theory, yes. I can't tell you. I'm not. You know, I have no confidence in history. But it was a fun read. It was a very fun read. Okay. So he says, okay. So historical lover of the parade. So how could Rashi say this? So he says, oh, what he must mean is that Paris and Pirkon eno matzoy, but kvura chashiva matzoy. But now he says, but kvura. Hang on a second. Why is it matzoy? What like some? You know, half the time she should bury him, not the other way around. So Kvura shouldn't be, right? Kvura, not only can Kvura happen more than once, Kvura doesn't even happen more than half the time. So his answer is, no, women die faster, more often. And also, you know, people get divorced, right? So Ktuba and, right, Ktuba, you know, it should be the other way, right? Ktuba doesn't happen unless, right, Ktuba doesn't happen unless he dies first, and Kvura doesn't happen unless she dies first. So he could have just said, you know what, they're Matzah because they're both 50%, but he doesn't. Right, he says women die younger and ksubas happen. Okay, I assume that was empirically true in his time. Okay, but Rabbi Hanal Pirish, right, here we go. Rabbi Hanal Pirish says, Eino poda yoter mikhdei demeha, aval kidei demeha poda. Rabbi Hanal says, no, even the second and third time, the husband has an unlimited obligation to be poda. It's just that he has no obligation to be poda more than worth after the first time. But husband actually has an unlimited obligation to redeem. Okay, so there's a fundamental machlokas between Rashi and Rabbeinu Chananel. Rashi says that the framework of the ketubah is one pidyon and that's it. And Rabbeinu Chananel says, no, the framework is unlimited pidyon at worth, but only one above worth. So that's really hard to figure out, like, how Rabbeinu Chananel gets this out of, like, right? Why would they put this in the ketubah? How does that fit into? So you have to claim, well, because they know ein podinus ashvim yoter michle demayim, but they also think that husbands have an obligation towards wives, so they end up with this compromise. Okay, interesting, interesting claim. All right, we don't have to read the end of the test, so it's just where it explains.
Wasn't that a way of reading the Gemara?
Yeah, but we'd write just trying to show you this machlokas rishonim, right? The Rebbe agrees that a husband has an unlimited obligation, and Rav Shimon Gamliel would also agree with that, right? Actually, so the amount, right? He totally reverses that the history in terms of Rashi. According to Rashi, it's just a Tanai Ketubah for once, and Rav Nachman says, no, it's a Tanai Ketubah forever. So the Chiddush presumably is then, like, you know, the only reason we say that he doesn't have to redeem her for more than her worth is because of Tikkun Olam. Right? It's an interesting question whether without Tikkun Olam, whether we would think the obligation of husbands to redeem extends to more than worth. And that raises an important general question, right? Which is, when we say there's an obligation to redeem captives, right? So what is the obligation? Is the obligation to redeem captives no matter what? And just sometimes we won't go all the way for the obligation. Or is the obligation to redeem captives at a reasonable price? So I said last time that I don't think there can be. I don't think it makes sense to say there's an obligation to redeem captives at any price, because then you're just making negotiations silly. Right. Anybody, if the captors know that you have an obligation to, right, that you have an obligation to, right, to spend whatever it is, right? So then, why would the captors ever settle for less? So it has to be that there's just a higher level of reasonable, right? It has to be that. Okay, fine. So let's now turn to the Gemara in Gittin, which is actually the source of everything else in the sugya. Right. So now we're on page 6. So Maran Gittin, right, begins with the anonymous statement that we said, "V'ein podinus hashvuyim yeser al kadei demayan mipnei tikkun olam." Right, you can't redeem the captives more than they're worth because of tikkun olam. Rav Shimon Gamliel shows up later in the Mishnah, but right, but he doesn't disagree with this. So this sounds like a consensus position, right? And there's a secondary position, which is you also don't free the captives, and this is sometimes people use the reductio ad absurdum. We're going to tell people they can't escape. No, we won't tell people they can't escape. Right? They don't right. People don't have to worry about the next captive, right? If they escape, and then which we'll get right. Certainly, we're not going to tell people they can't escape if their lives are at risk, and that will raise the question about whether this Mishnah is in the context of lives at risk. Right, does the line "we don't redeem captives for more than they're worth"? Does that apply even if the captives' lives are at risk? Right, because are we really going to claim then if the cases are parallel that we don't even free captives if their lives are at risk? Does that make any sense at all? Hard to say. Right, so the simplest reading of the Mishnah is that the Mishnah makes the claim that you don't redeem captives for more than value even if the captives' lives are at risk. Which is also the simplest reading of the claim that the reason that Pidyon Shvuyim is such a great mitzvah is because Pidyon Shvuyim includes all the other risks, which include death. Right. So the simplest reading is that this line in the Mishnah, whether it is an obligation or whether it's a prohibition or a removal of obligation, applies even if the captives are at risk. Okay, we can evade it by talking about different degrees of risk. By the way, that's the simplest way of reading. Okay, here's the Gemara. The Bailu. When we say this because of Tikkun Olam, is that Mishum Dochaka de Tziburahu? Is it because we're afraid of imposing excessively, right? Of creating hardship for the congregation, right? And now Rashi says, Ein al lidchoka tzibur will havir lidei aniyut bishvil elu. We don't have an obligation to put the congregation in a hard place and bring them into aniyut as a result of this. So does that actually mean that objectively that you have to spend whatever it is that doesn't make you poor? Right, that's what we're worried about. Right, everyone agrees that you have to redeem captives. Right, that if you could redeem captives at a price which does not create any long-term risk of poverty, then great. And we're only worried because it has a risk of poverty? Or is Rashi saying, no, it means you don't have to change the community's standard of living. And there's also maybe the day I knew it means, right? Anything which will make a material change in the community's standard of living, that you don't have to do that. Okay. Rashi says the day I knew it. So the simplest thing is that, right, is that Rashi thinks the concern is that you'll actually bring the community to some situation defined as poverty, which again raises the question, which, you know, is a policy question everywhere, like how do we define poverty, since poverty is often defined by, relatively. Right, the poverty rate in the U.S. is, 50, 60 times the average wage in many other countries. Okay. Odilma. Maybe it's Mishum Delo, and we have the word Ligrivu, other versions of Lignivu, right, that we're afraid that we're going to encourage further captures. And there are two ways of understanding that. I think the simplest way, right, one way is we're paying so much that we're afraid we're going to encourage people generally to engage in the process of hostage taking, or we're afraid that given that people have a choice of captives, they'll capture Jews more than non-Jews because Jews cost more. And that raises the question. We say that we are paying the going rate, the risk of demand. Does that mean the going rate for human beings or the going rate for Jews?
Jews are worth more. Jews have a.
It could be that Jews
capacity to pay and a.
If you have capacity to pay, so Jews are worth. Worth is just the market price. The market price for Jews is going to be higher than the market price for non-Jews if Jews pay more. Right. So it could be. Right? So it could be that our public policies we don't want to encourage kidnappers, or it could be we don't want to. But given that there are kidnappers, we don't want them to particularly pick out Jews. Okay. And that also has. Right now, like, what happens if the kidnappers are going to pick out Jews anyway? Right, now, aside from the question, how we pick out market prices, is market price established by the last price paid in the market, or is market price paid, established a period of time? And the obvious question that everyone is, what happens if there's no market? Right. So as we talked about on Shabbos, that prior to the Entebbe hijacking. The policy of the state of Israel was not to negotiate with terrorists. Therefore, by definition, there was no market. Right. So when the question came up, well, now right, when Ravadi gives the permission to negotiate, right? So what's the market? Aside from the question of the market is defined by money, right? When you, when you define it as other cap, other prisoners, all sorts of things like that. So like the whole conversation takes place in a weird space, because we're assuming, you know, they're assuming a slave market, right? What if there are no slave markets? All the economics here are going to have to be transposed in some way if you want to make this hockey conversation legally relevant. Okay. Rashi says here, Vinafkamina, right? Rashi says Vinafkamina. Why do we care which the two reasons are? Im yesh lo av ashir, o karov shuratzelif deoto b'damim harbe, v'lo yapileu al tzibur. So Rashi says, aha. So here is the machloket. If it's because of bringing the community to poverty, so then we don't care if private people spend their funds. But if it's a question of raising the price in whatever way, so then we do care if private people spend their funds. Right. So the first way Rashi says, right, you can figure it out. Rashi will say, okay, we won't obligate the community to rescue people at above price, but we won't constrain private people. And the other way we'll forbid private people from engaging in this kind of a conversation. Obviously, there's a middle case, which is like, what happens if it's the major taxpayer? And the major taxpayer in your community is going to use all their money to redeem their relatives. That's going to impoverish the community. Right. So the line between individuals and community is not as bright as Rashi says it, but Rashi says it because it sets up the next line of the Gemara. Right? The last line of the Gemara is Tashma. The Levi Bar Darga, I have no idea who Levi Bar Darga is. If any of you can figure out who or when Levi Bar Darga lives, there is no other Bar Darga or Bar Daraga or anything like that anywhere in rabbinic literature that I can find. So this is total mystery. Whoever Levi Bar Darga was. Pirkei Levirte B'Tleisar Alfei Dinari Zahav. So he redeemed his daughter for 12,000 dinarim of gold, which is generally assumed that was not her worth on the slave market. Okay. Alma, Mishum Doker Tziburu. The Gemara says, ah, like, here's the proof that it's because of the community, because look, here's what this person did, and he's a private figure, and they didn't stop him. To which the Gemara, right, Abaye gives this great answer. He says, Uman Leimelon de Bertson Chachamim Avad, Delmash Lo Bertson Chachamim Avad. Maybe he acted illegally. Because Abaye doesn't know who Levi Bedarga is either. Right, so it's a way of knowing whether Levi Bar Darga, right? Somebody says Levi Bar Darga, who knows Levi Bar Darga is, right? The simplest way of understanding what's going on with the Baye. Now, I think that there is a in the 21st century, right, people give this shir. So right, so a lot of people, I think, have given the shir. I have actually heard it, but I've seen it and I've heard it quoted. So you see, like, you know, that this is a very hard halacha to keep. And there may always have been a gap between the law and the books, which is an attempt to discourage, and people's practice, where people, in the end of the day, if people have the money, they're going to redeem their captives. And then the question is, what do we do if there's, right? You know, and so then, right? And you will see, right? There's a marshal that we'll see in a few weeks, I hope. Right? The marshal says, look, the communal practice has always been to redeem captives more than they're worth, and that goes back to the Gemara, right? So it's an interesting way of reading that, right? Of reading this Gemara, that it, you know, that Abaye is saying, look, you know, on this issue, you can't give me any evidence from practice because people will do what they're going to do, all right? And they shouldn't have. Okay, we'll try also. Okay, whereas Tosfos says,
another important distinction, yeah, is that we're talking about individuals here, not polity.
Yeah, that's the whole point, right? Right? That's where proof is, right? Individual, right? Yeah, so Abaye was right, right? That it must be because we're worried about the community, right? Sorry, it must be that we're worried about the community because that's why we didn't care if individuals did it, right? Because in terms of raising the price, right, that doesn't make a difference. Okay, the Tosfos here we'll get to the right. Tosfos says the one that matters to us is v'yesh lomar. Okay, right, it says, look, you can't, nobody ever tried to prevent people from spending all their money on self-redemption. What about the daughter? And it says, and ishto kigufo, so don't even try, right? But daughters have nothing to do with ishto. Daughters are not kigufo, right? So that's right. There you have that line being introduced. That the um, that um, right? That the laws of redeeming wives are not related to the laws of everybody else, but they, but then Tosafot says that, but only wives, even daughters, are not different because it's really limited to a narrow claim, ishto kegufo. Rabbi Yonatan HaKohen Miloniel, right? This will finish with this. Has, I think, a really interesting language. He says, because they would raise the price of captives. That's such a fascinating line. Therefore, we don't teach people, we don't habituate people, right? Milamdin is an interesting line, to redeem captives for more than they're worth. So it sounds like, he's setting up like an interesting claim, like where we don't actually think we can prevent people. But we also don't tell people that they have the choice.
Malamdi mean in the sense of establishing halacha?
Not only establishing halacha, we don't tell people that's what they should do. Right? We just sort of like, you know, people come and say you don't have to. And we don't say you can't because, right, we don't want them to, but either, you know, but it might be, it's a kind of like interesting claim, whereas we don't want people to do it, but we want people to be the kind of people who would do it. Right? That's a very, right? That's a very hard balance, right? Because we tell them you can't do it, right? Judaism is rough and harsh, right? You know, it'd be, and right, how can you possibly leave these people in captivity and all those, right? So, you know what? There's a good rational public policy reason not to do it. If you ask, like, should you do it? There's a good, rational public policy reason for you not to do it. And that's all. It's a very humble position, right, as to what, right, the limits have been against us. Right? We're not talking about relatives here, right? And that's why we don't teach the community. It means that the rabbi doesn't run the appeal. Right? We don't make it a public thing. The public position is, right, public money is only going to be used to redeem the captives, to redeem the captives at their worth. And then there are going to be people who give earmarked appeals for Pidyon Shvuyim. Right? And, you know, and do we turn them down? That's hard to say. Okay. I think that's a good place to stop for the week. Thank you all for